Good morning. Another Hawaii protest is scheduled to show continued solidarity with Dakota Sioux over the Standing Rock pipeline. We'll talk with Kumu Hula and social justice advocate Vicky Holt-Takamine. Meanwhile, we'll look at the aftermath of a weekend of protests in Honolulu over the election of Donald Trump. Later this hour, we talk with Liz Reese, the organizer of the gathering of World Can't Wait Hawaii. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. There's real art to floral design if you know what you're doing, and it's celebrated in Tamara Rigney and Rico Reed's new book, Ohi, Gathering and Arranging Hawaii's Flora. Tamara's with us in our studio. And Andrew Lloyd Webber has created a kids' version of School of Rock, the musical. It's playing on Kauai.
That's some of the conversation for this Monday, November 14th. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this news.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters.
And all the way to Hawaii, too. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. And you, sir, good morning to Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Of course, Woody Guthrie wrote that song before Hawaii was a state. But
that's true, but we include it nonetheless.
We certainly do.
We do.
Standing Rock has become a real national flashpoint, hasn't it?
You bet. And no signs of that going away
nope.
Anytime soon. But it's going to have another meaning for Hawaii come tomorrow. Now, remember at the IUCN World Conservation Congress 2 months ago, a key takeaway was that indigenous peoples worldwide are now communicating and organizing in support of each other in ways they'd not previously done. The movement to protect land and water rights in North Dakota over the Standing Rock Access Pipeline was an example of that kind of solidarity. Protesters of the 30-meter telescope and others went to Standing Rock, and when they came home, they continued to advocate. Tomorrow, protesters in Hawaii will participate in the National Day of Solidarity for Standing Rock. Kumu Hula and Native Hawaiian advocate Vicky Holt-Takamine joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Aloha.
We have been watching as people have been going to Standing Rock and then coming back and encouraging Hawaii folks to understand that this is a directly translatable issue for people in Hawaii, particularly for Native Hawaiians. How has that message been percolating through the Hawaiian community?
Well, for all of us, for Native Hawaiians, you know, our resources and our natural resources, our environment is really valuable for our protection of our traditional cultural practices. We've used our natural resources to feed ourselves, to clothe ourselves, so we understand what that means as indigenous people, that all of those natural resources, the cultural resources, are vital to our survival. Water, for example, is a resource that is very valuable for everyone all across the world. We cannot survive without water. So access to water, protection of water, those are really important issues. And this is the same issue that the Sioux Nation are working to protect their water resources. That Missouri River that runs right through their state, through their reservation, is being impacted by this Dakota Access Pipeline.
In the wake of the election, this argument seems to be now a very different one that would have been held maybe, you know, 2-3 weeks ago.
Well, it's really important now that we impress upon President Obama, hopefully, to exercise his right as the president to stop that pipeline, divert it away from the Missouri River that is going to be really... I don't know if our local people understand what fracking is and what the pipeline really does. So the drill, they're going to drill about a mile down into to try and reach the shoal to purposely crack it. And that's why it's called fracking. And then they're going to push millions of gallons of water filled with toxic chemicals into that well to then push it through the fissures that are in the shoal that will then allow them to extract the oil. And then that gets pushed up. What happens to the water that they've contaminated? They get put into wells. Some of them leak. So all that leaks into our environment, leaks into the soil. So the idea of pushing millions of gallons of water with toxins into the earth to force those fissures open, and not having any resource, not having any way to take care of that contaminated water.
We haven't obviously had fracking issues in Hawaii, but in understanding what this means for the Dakota Sioux, it's a completely different slice of the argument, but it's the same argument. That's what you're saying.
Yes. So that river that runs through their nation is their lifeline. It is and not only their lifeline, but the lifeline for North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, all the way down into Illinois. Those four states that the pipeline will travel through will be impacted. That river feeds is so. In Hawaii, we understand what Kanawai is. Kanawai means law. And the word law, kana, vai, is based off of the word vai. Vai meaning water. So our laws are based around the laws of water, and water as a vital resource for our livelihood.
Which seems to be exactly the reason why many in Hawaii seem to be taking this up and advocating so strongly.
We understand that water is life. I mean, that is malama i ka vai. We've been talking about that for generations.
So what happens then as we go into tomorrow and there are people who will be gathering at First Hawaiian Banks across the state because
First Hawaiian Bank is owned by the overall company that runs the Dakota pipeline. Yes, and they own several other banks throughout the nation. So First Hawaiian Bank is, you know, one of the largest banks in Hawaii. And, you know, I'm really sad that we can't do anything about that except take our money out and move it to another bank or move it to a credit union.
Because it's a subsidiary. I mean, it's not directing some of this activity
still,
that's happening.
Yeah,
but the idea that they're attached to it.
Yes. And that's why the DAPL hashtag, you know, against the Dakota Access Pipeline is happening around our local bank, the First Hawaiian Bank.
That's going to happen tomorrow.
3:30
to 5:30 around the state. And it's going to be part of the national
day. It's a national movement. It's a national call out to everybody. And this call out has reached New Zealand. So you see New Zealand haka being performed, you know, in support of the Sioux Nation.
So what happens, Vicki, when this is, you know, now moving through the next couple of months and then we have a change of administration? If nothing were to happen while President Obama is still in office,
this is critical that we push between now and January 20th when Donald Trump takes over as president. It's going to be open field for everything that we know of as environmental protection. We're getting, I mean, I'm fearful for climate change. I'm fearful for our environment, our natural and our cultural resources, because all those protections that we have put in place over the last 20 years can be wiped out in one little sweep. We're going to have a new chief justice being appointed under Trump. We have new EPA director already in place and not supportive of our environment. We're going to have these pipelines which will exude methane gas affecting climate change, and it's going to affect everybody around the world.
There's also the fear that no matter what happens in this lame duck period, that could also be reversed.
We're hopeful that everything that we've put in place will be reversed. And that's Trump's message to all of us. So, you know, I'm calling on the Democratic Party to get their act together, because I don't think that Trump lost. I think the Democratic Party lost it. I mean, I don't think that Trump won. I think the Democratic Party lost this election.
Well, we'll see what happens and who may be losing out as we watch continually what's going on at Standing Rock and what will be happening tomorrow in Hawaii around the state. at First Hawaiian Bank Buildings.
Please join us and bring your signs, hashtag DAPL, D-A-P-L.
We'll have all that information on our Facebook
awesome.
Page. Vicky Holtakamine, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Coming in. Vicky Holtakamine is a kumu hula and a Native Hawaiian advocate for social justice issues, the protection of Native Hawaiian rights, and the natural and cultural resources of Hawaii. In 2001, she created the nonprofit Pa'i Foundation to serve the needs of her Hawaiian community and those who make Hawaii their home. And she's been helping to organize tomorrow's protest in support of the Dakota Sioux at Standing Rock.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:14 and coming up, celebrating the art of floral design. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about an endemic species whose numbers are threatened and which often fall victim to light pollution. They're not as susceptible to avian malaria as other native bird species, but their numbers are threatened from a variety of other sources. So far, they're only listed as endangered on the island of Oahu, with light pollution believed to be the direct cause. They've been reported to dive directly into approaching auto headlights, probably as part of their hunting behavior. They also build nests on the ground, which makes their eggs and young vulnerable to one of the more destructive introduced species, the small Asian mongoose, and other predators too. This island native makes its home in forests and grasslands and is one of the Aumakua, or ancestor spirits, revered by Native Hawaiians. We'll give you the Latin name for free. It's Azio Flammeus sanwicensis, but this morning we're looking for its English and Hawaiian names, and we'll be back with it in half an hour. If you know, you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
I'm Vivian Lee from the Hawaii State Foundation on Culture and the Arts. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Hawaii's flora offer a nearly infinite palette of shapes and colors to the designer who knows what to do with them. But to the novice, they can overwhelm. It's an embarrassment of riches, and good design calls for an ability to select, mix and match, and impose a kind of order on nature's chaotic beauty. That's what Tamara Rigney and photographer Mariko Reed are going for in a new book called Ohi, Gathering and Arranging Hawaii's Flora. And Tamara's with us this morning.
Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess it starts with gathering, doesn't it?
It does. And there's so much around us, and we really just want people to take a pair of clippers and go in their yard, bring it indoors, and it really makes you happy.
Chances are once you start doing that, you're going to come up with your own design notions, I would think, right?
Totally. And we're not design snobs at all. You know, it's literally just bringing these materials indoors, and there's definitely a few tips to make, you know, design tips, and we cover that in the book, but just get out there and start foraging.
What are some sort of overarching principles of design that you might keep in mind doing this?
Well, definitely scale. I mean, thinking about the size of your vase as compared to your flowers, There's a few basic tips with color. Mm-hmm. I think that can get overwhelming in Hawaii because we have so many different colors of flora.
And, yeah.
You know, sometimes just scaling it back can really help an arrangement feel more contemporary. Like, you don't have to use every color.
Yeah. Well, you know, the loud, bright colors can overwhelm the little subtle colors, right? But when you take a sort of an in-between color and isolate it, maybe have just a couple of simple shades, you can appreciate it more. Yeah,
yeah, and it's all just about experimentation, and that's the beauty of just using materials that are around you. Just go out there and play, hold materials together in your hand, and you know, if it doesn't work, just put something else in.
You also need to know how to care for the plants, and you address that in the book as well, right?
Yeah, so the book is all about cut flowers, but there's definitely a few tips that you can do to make them last longer, and changing the water every day, using a floral food does help, trimming stems. But the great thing about Hawaii's flowers is a lot of the things we have will last for weeks. So,
just because it's the hardier plants that have survived here, yeah?
Yeah, just in general, like the kind of jungly tropical plants are really waxy. And, you know, spraying them with water and doing things to kind of mimic where they actually grow, you can really get them to survive in your house for a long time.
That makes sense. You sometimes hear of Hawaii's flora, you know, described by a new visitor as a riot of color. And and the trouble with riots is they're disorganized. Right?
Yeah, riots don't get a good rap, do they?
Yeah, so this is not a riot, more like a, how should we describe it, just sort of a drawing room conversation among plants or something, yeah?
Yeah, well, it just takes a contemporary view of floral design and just using the materials here in just kind of a different way.
When you say a contemporary view, does that mean that floral design is something that, like other forms of art, has a sort of an evolution of its own?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, always trends and styles. And the thing that I've kind of always taken this approach, but just kind of a more casual, laid-back approach. Nothing really rigid. Mm-hmm. Just this sort of like bohemian local vibe. And that's what we're going for.
Well, you know, the trouble with the rules that are laid down for art is that by the time you figure out what they are, they've changed, right?
Right. And which is what is great about our book is because it's just classic, simple design.
You know, one of the things that you've done with these photographs is you've placed the designs in, I suppose you'd call it, a real-world setting, right? They're on bookshelves, they're on tables. They look as if they could be in your house.
Yeah, and that was a huge part of the book, is we wanted to feature local homes that felt real, they felt lived in. So we had a lot of great people let us into their homes. And Mariko, my partner in the book, is an architectural photographer, and I think the photos are amazing. I'm really, really happy with them.
They're all lit with natural light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything. We just showed up in the morning, did our shoots, and yeah, it was very natural.
Well, it also speaks to and you address this in the introduction to the book, the fact that our homes in Hawaii are open to the outside in ways that very few parts of the world have, yeah?
Mm-hmm. And part of that is just, yeah, with the plants, it's just bringing more of that nature in. You know, we already have sand in our houses. We have the geckos crawling at night, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah, blurring those lines even more.
I was telling a mainland friend about geckos, and he said, his response was, "What do you do to get rid of them?" And I said, "Why would anyone want to do that?"
You're like, they eat the bugs.
But it's well, as soon as I explained that, it was, you know, he completely understood.
I know. And, I mean, part of the funny thing with the flowers and arranging and sourcing is, like, yeah, you're going to encounter some bugs.
Sure.
Out there. You're going to get to know the geckos that are living in your heliconia plants in the yard. But I think that's the fun part of it. And hopefully if we can inspire people to go out and, you know, cut their own things and interact with nature a little more, I feel like we're doing our job.
Inevitably, in doing this work, you've got favorites of your own, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. And that's part of the book, as well as we highlight some of our favorite plant materials and we give tips and, you know, a little bit of history on how they came to Hawaii.
What's an example of a favorite of yours, Tamara?
A favorite of mine lately has actually just been bananas. Sometimes I just use the fruits in like cluster arrangements. But the flowers are so beautiful. And we have all these interesting Polynesian varieties that I think a lot of them were introduced over 100 years ago. And they have these small flowers that you can make arrangements out of. And they're just striking.
Never even knew there were such things.
Yeah, and the more we did research for this book, the more I figured it out. There's, yeah, dozens of varieties.
Do you still find yourself making discoveries like that?
Oh, yeah, every day. And I think it's just how I've trained my eye. I'm always looking at the plants around me when I'm driving, when I'm anything.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I find something new every week I want to play with.
Well, you can kind of train people to do the same, can't you?
Yeah, and I mean, part of the book is we obviously don't want you to go steal things from your neighbor's house or the forest. I mean, ask politely and follow the laws. But, yeah, notice what's around you. And, you know, people will let you cut a few branches from their yard.
And just get outside.
Just get outside.
Sounds like a great idea.
And to your farmer's markets as well. And a lot of the book is you can go buy $5 of flowers at the farmer's markets and then supplement with things from your yard.
Makes sense. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Chris.
Floral designer Tamara Rigney and photographer Mariko Reed have created a new book called Ohi, Gathering and Arranging Hawaii's Flora, published by Paiko Press.
Hawaii Public Radio gratefully acknowledges John Lindborg of Kailua Kona, Dora King of Pahoa, and Olga Monte and Paul Stinoyan of Hilo for their recent membership gifts. And we thank all of our listeners for your support. If you've yet to join HPR, well, you can rectify that right now by becoming a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. When should signs be posted to alert swimmers of dangerous water quality? It's been an ongoing struggle for environmental groups, but now there could be a successful outcome with the State Department of Health. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so this is kind of a yucky story to talk about because we're not just talking about, you know, bacteria that are there for other reasons than human and human refuse that sometimes makes its way into the ocean.
Right. So Nathan Eagle actually describes an incident that happened in August off of Ala Moana with some surfers. And they noticed what they described as big, dark globs floating in the water. Well, guess what? They were not sea turtles. In fact, it was feces. And there were no signs posted to warn the surfers. One of the people that Nathan talked to actually went and got checked out with the doctor, whether she had hepatitis A or any other contamination. And then she spent the next couple of days in bed, you know, emotionally and physically wiped out. Well, it turns out we believe that fecal matter came from homeless people near the park. And officials actually saw homeless people dumping buckets of excrement into the ocean. And therefore, problem solved. But the problem remains how to deal with this. And not just human waste. That's something the state mandates, that you look for that in our waters. But also animal feces. That's something that the EPA and others are starting to warn against, because who wants to have our beautiful waters full of this material?
Yeah, and you wonder what the sign is going to look like for that. But now that you've got the, you know, like Surf Rider Foundation and others that have been trying to make the point that we need to have better warnings, is there something in the works that means that we're now going to actually see better warnings and letting us know that this is the kind of contamination we're talking about?
we're definitely going to have to wait and see what the when, where, how, and why in terms of the signs being posted. But the good news, the reality check, is that the Surf Rider Foundation, which actually does its own testing, it routinely goes around and tests, is now cooperating with the state health department. And they've actually had quite a few meetings. And yes, they disagree on some points, but there's general agreement that they need to do something about this. Now, you got to be careful. You don't want to freak out all the tourists. You know, the tourist industry in particular is concerned about this. There is bacteria in the water no matter what. But when and where should signs go up? In front of Waikiki? That makes sense. What about on some of the remote beaches on the neighbor islands? There's concern about that as well. But the bottom line we hear from the state is, you know, the public has a right to know about what's in their water and whether it's safe or not.
Well, as some would say, that's a victory in and of itself. We'll see, though, how that becomes evident in what we're able to see when we've got these things going on. And we know that happens frequently after big rains, too. Thanks, Chad.
We'll keep you posted, Beth Ann.
I know you will. Thank you. We'll talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
A Tea Party role was something you worked your way up to. A first step that would lead to more ambitious steps. Clown gigs, dinner theater, and eventually, commercial work.
The Land of Opportunity. This week on Selected Shorts. From PRI, Public Radio International.
Tuesday at 5 p.m. following Travel with Rick Steves.
Now, since last Tuesday's election of Donald Trump, protesters across the nation have shown their extreme displeasure by taking to the streets. L.A., Cincinnati, and New York are just a few of the cities that drew tens of thousands over several nights of largely peaceful gatherings. Riots in Portland were the exception. Anti-Trump marchers and gatherings marked this past weekend in Honolulu. Liz Reese is an organizer with World Can't Wait, and she's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
There were these, you know, sort of serial marches and rallies planned for this past weekend where there was a lot of cross-pollination and seemed to be a lot of coordination among organizations creating and organizing these protests. How many people do you think were involved total?
Well, World Can't Wait called for a sign-holding in action on Friday, and we had about 100 people that came. It was at the corner of Ala Moana and Atkinson. And then there were a bunch of other events that took place over the weekend organized by other groups. So that was very heartening to see so many people, different groups, different ideologies coming together. You know, opposing Trump really crosses over to every issue. Anyone concerned about humanity or the planet should be out there expressing outrage. And I want to quickly let the listeners know that World Can't Wait is calling for another protest and sign holding. This Wednesday, November 16th, from 4 to 6 p.m., also at the corner of Ala Moana and Atkinson,
right.
We'll be at the Diamond Head side to Ala Moana Beach Park.
Yeah, that's a famous corner for a lot of sign waving and protesting. But
yes.
As you look at this, Liz, it seems that these coordinated events are in some ways more to relieve a general feeling of anxiety and upset as opposed to looking for something that is an outcome that would be possible. How do you deal with people who are so angry and so upset and yet looking for an outcome that may not be possible?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk you see from the media of saying these protesters are just hateful and, you know, now's not the time for hate. And I would argue that the protests are not hateful at all. But they
well,
are
nobody's calling. Nobody.
Angry.
Hang on. Nobody here is calling them hateful. But
oh,
just asking.
I don't believe
asking,
you are at all.
Asking.
That's kind
the point,
of
though.
Been a talking point out there in society.
But as we are talking about here and in Hawaii and across the nation too, that all of these protests that may give vent to a lot of upset and anxiety and relieve some of that in some part. But then there comes a point where, you know, even now we're watching them. You know, not peter out, but they certainly are diminishing even over the past couple of days. How do you look at what happens as we move forward after the protests, or even if they were to continue, to, you know, create a system that isn't in place to give the relief that a lot of people want. I mean, after all, these are anti-Trump protests, and in January, he's going to be installed as president.
Yes, and I think we should keep protesting now. I think people should keep protesting after he's elected. There's already a huge call for a Million Woman March in D.C. on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, which is January 22nd, because women are very fearful that the right to abortion and reproductive freedom could be taken away, even more than the restrictions that already exist. So, you know, I think it's very important that people are out there. And I believe that there is no reconciliation with a racist, you know, hateful, woman-hating, Islamophobe, homophobe president-elect.
So what happens over the next 4 years? How do you envision the next 4 years?
It's going to be interesting. I think there's going to be a lot of people out in the streets. The fact that, you know, Donald Trump is now talking about people he's appointing, such as Steve Bannon, you know, very reactionary, far right wing. This is very telling. And I think we're going to need to be a lot more organized. You know, we've been seeing a year with lots of resistance, which is a good thing. Things like Black Lives Matter, things like Standing Rock, which you were talking about earlier. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this. I think people have to be out and there has to be resistance.
So as you are envisioning the coming years, you're seeing a great deal of tumult and a lot more of ongoing protests, regardless of Inauguration Day happening and no sense of settling down and accepting what has happened in this democratic process.
Yes, and I believe people should not accept it at all.
So what does that say about the process then?
About which process?
About the democratic process, that you had people who got out in greater numbers and they elected a president that a lot of other people don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, well, if it were somebody that we like, it would be okay. But if we don't like it, it's not okay. That seems to thwart the whole idea behind what the democratic process is supposed to stand for.
Well, I believe it's really important to be out there opposing Trump. You know, I've been having this discussion with a lot of people. And, you know, someone very pointedly reminded me that, you know, Hitler was also elected. And Hitler, at a certain time in history, learned to tone down his rhetoric and appear, you know, calm the way Trump is right now trying to do. So I want to encourage people not to be good Germans. You know, just because this person was elected, I think, is very telling about this system, that this is the so-called legitimate president-elect is outrageous, and people must be outraged.
There is a lot of outrage, and people are expressing a lot of the same feelings that you have.
Mm-hmm.
But again, going back to if we say this is how this happens in America, where do you see this going forward?
I think I see it going forward with resistance. I think that is what is needed right now. You know, a big part of the only reason that police brutality and police terror and police murder became part of the national dialogue was because we saw a real movement speaking out around it. And I think that's what we need right now at an even higher level.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us this morning, and we'll, of course, be watching. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I hope people can join us this Wednesday from 4 to 6 to speak out against Trump at the corner of Ala Moana and Atkinson.
Liz Reese is a political activist and organizer with World Can't Wait, which fights what it sees as social justice crimes. The group was an organizer of one of this weekend's protests, and as you heard, a coming protest this Wednesday over the election of Donald Trump.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. The world is a complicated place. It has trillions of moving parts, and everyone contributes in their own way. But every now and then, someone comes along and does something that pulls all the pieces together. Robert Black was such a person. He was born in Hawaii and went on to become the CEO of one of our largest construction firms. Upon his death, he left $60 million to the Hawaii Community Foundation. This gift essentially made the foundation what it is today. It enabled the creation of thousands of grants, and some of these have changed the face of our state. Beneficiaries have been Punahou School, the Hawaii YMCA, Pacific Care, and the E.E. Black Scholarship Fund. Possibly the greatest impact felt across our islands was the funding for the Polynesian Voyaging Society, which, because of the epic voyages of Hokulea, rekindled the Hawaiian Renaissance and all that came with it. This happened because one man chose to give to the future, Robert Black. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, Alzheimer's is an exceptionally cruel and little understood illness, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a memory thief. And today we're going to talk a little bit about some of the ways that those who have loved ones suffering from this condition can really still have an impact in the lives of the person with Alzheimer's.
It can be heartbreaking for family members as well as for the person suffering from the disease, can't it?
Well, it sure can. You know, the person suffering from the disease sometimes may not really know that they actually can't remember their family members. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times family sometimes look at this individual and say, they should be the same, they look the same, why can't they remember? And yet we're going to talk about some of the things that happen when people with Alzheimer's still become part of a family unit, when we still interact with them, when we still include them in gatherings, because there's this deeper part of the brain that although it may not remember names, it remembers a level of comfort and how important it is to not isolate these individuals, forget to visit because we figure they won't remember us anyway. There are studies that show that even that comforting presence can last for hours in someone's brain despite having Alzheimer's.
And people respond to signs of affection, right? Gestures of affection.
Absolutely. And it does get to this deeper area of our brain which is not directly affected from Alzheimer's, this fight or flight, this brain part that's very primitive that helps people to realize that they're in danger or they're not. And that's the part that never changes. Mm-hmm. When we see people who are in nursing homes or care homes and they don't remember much, our first human inclination is to say, I don't want to go there. I don't want to visit them. I don't think it's helpful. We're going to talk about how it really can be.
Well, that's going to be valuable to a lot of people, Kathy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5. In today's backyard quiz, we thought about Asio flammeus sandwichensis, an endemic species with an unfortunate hunting instinct that causes it to dive toward automobile headlights. Its numbers were once abundant on Oahu, but now it's listed as endangered on that island, in part because of brightly lit highways like H3, where it has had a number of collisions. It's considered endangered because it nests on the ground, losing eggs and young to the invasive mongoose. The species was first classified by one Andrew Bloxam in 1825, who was serving as the naturalist aboard the HMS Blonde. In recent years, it has fallen victim to a mysterious illness called sick owl syndrome that may be related to pesticides, light pollution, or food shortages, among other possible sources. Scientists don't know yet, but preservation of the pueo, our Hawaiian short-eared owl, is a priority.
And Wayne Bernard called us. He knew the answer and will be receiving the HPR prize. It's now 8:45. That's today's quiz. And if you've got a question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in our dark island skies and what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, who we welcome back now. Aloha, Christopher. Welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for the planet Mars in the southern sky after sunset. Should be easy to spot because not only is it bright, but it is also distinctly red. And the moon this week will begin to wane.
And this week we have an exciting return back to the Mauna Kea summit where some new equipment, I understand, is being installed. Is that what's happening?
It is indeed. A very exciting development from Mauna Kea this week and from the Subaru Observatory. Engineers and scientists at Subaru have successfully tested an exciting new piece of kit called the Coronagraphic High Angular Resolution Imaging Spectrograph. Oh, boy. Or CHARIS for short. This new instrument is being rigorously tested before it begins full-time operation in February of 2017.
And so what does this new piece of gear do?
It is designed to hunt down exoplanets, planets around other stars out there in the universe.
And this sounds tricky because when we look at stars, they're so much bigger and brighter than the planet.
It is tricky indeed. And CHARIS is designed to block out light from the star so astronomers can directly image the orbiting planets. To give you an example of just how tricky this can be, trying to spot a planet around a nearby star is like trying to spot a moth around a bright streetlight that's miles away.
That does sound tricky. This is sort of the same phenomenon as that time they thought there might be some giant structures around some planet because they were looking at the light as it orbited.
That's right, and they couldn't exactly figure out what was going on because the star they were looking at seemed to be dimming mysteriously.
Right. And so how will the team up at Subaru handle that?
Very gently, my friend. They will use CHARIS in combination with their amazing adaptive optic system to help us give the clearest, most detailed images of these planetary systems yet. Adaptive optics helps eliminate the distortion in the Earth's atmosphere that causes images to blur and shimmer. By combining the power of these two instruments, planet hunters on Mauna Kea are going to be very busy indeed.
Well, we'll be looking for some results from this new piece of technology, and we appreciate hearing about it from you. It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
There's no better performing arts education than a full-scale theatrical production with singing, dancing, and live accompaniment. Andrew Lloyd Webber's School of Rock, the musical youth production, adds another dimension, a fledgling live band on stage, becoming a real band over the course of the show. It takes a lot to get a show like this off the ground, but the Hawaii Children's Theater, led by producer Deborah Blachowiak, is up to the challenge. HCT's production is running now, and we talked with Deborah about it just before opening night.
This show is School of Rock the Musical, and it is still on Broadway playing and has yet to even go on a national tour. So we had special permission from the producer, who is Andrew Lloyd Webber, to do a youth production of it. He's opened that up to schools and children's theaters around the country that want to do that. And they're accepting applications and then granting rights to do it if all actors are 18 and under.
Mm-hmm.
So for this particular show, we needed to find kids that could do all the adult roles. We had to find kids that could play instruments on stage, five of them. And we also had to find some kids to play in our orchestra, which means they had to also be able to read music. Many kids that do rock and roll play by ear and they don't read music. So we had a lot of casting to do, and we were able to pull it off, and they're doing great.
You could find all that on Kauai, huh?
We found it all on Kauai. Kauai has a lot of talented people.
Well, I know, but that's still, there's a lot of slots to fill there. That had to be pretty challenging.
It was, but we started our auditions in July. So they've only really been practicing since August. We had to find creative staff people who could take care of all of this. And we also were able to find an amazing director, musical directors, and staff.
That falls into your kuleana, doesn't it, as producer, to sort of pull all those elements together.
Yeah, I'm sort of the general contractor, but also I empty the garbage.
Yeah.
traffic
cop, psychiatrist, all those
everything.
Things, right?
Yes, everything that is really not creative falls into my lap. Raising money so that we can offer tickets at a fair price that we have been forever, which is really between $6 and $15 are our tickets.
Deborah, I don't think you should describe what you do as not creative, because you don't want to discourage aspiring producers out there. Without a producer, you got nothing, right?
That's true.
It is true. Give yourself some credit, you know.
Okay.
I had realized with a youth right production, you have to have kids in a youth production have to do the adult roles. I hadn't thought about that before. So that's what in this story of teachers and high school, kind of the high school principal, that kind of thing?
Right. Teachers, parents, high school principal is a huge role.
Yeah.
It's a female role and requires a lot of people know the movie. It was a very well-received movie.
Sure.
but they don't know that the play is a little bit different than the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually got a much nicer backstory about all the kids. And there are new songs that Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote. There's new speaking roles that Julian Fellows, who wrote Downton Abbey, wrote all the book for this. And there is opera to sing. There is regular Broadway musical style singing. There's rock and roll singing. It's quite diverse.
So it really got Andrew Lloyd Webberized, inspired by the movie, is what it sounds like.
Exactly. And it's really wonderful. It's a really fun and warm story.
And that's, for something like this, but basically the thrust of the story is to encourage kids to kind of look for the talent within themselves.
Yes, it is. And it's also a lot about music and what music can do for kids and their development and for everybody. It's about a love of music, basically, too.
I would hope that people would come out of the show wanting to support their school's music programs.
Yes, and even a lot of schools don't have music programs.
I know.
Certainly, high schools generally do, but when you get to the middle and the lower grade schools, sometimes the arts fall off. And that's one way that our organization, Hawaii Children's Theater, is we support the community. We take all kids from Kauai, doesn't matter what school they go to.
Mm-hmm.
And so we provide them with arts education.
Which is filling, these days at least, is filling a gap, isn't it?
Yes, I think it does.
Well, so that's a pretty rewarding aspect to your work. How many people in the cast for this show?
There are 41 actors.
Yikes.
All 18 and under, as needed. It's a pretty, kind of a young cast. Our principal, who plays Dewey Finn, he is 15, but he's doing just fine, playing an adult and playing the guitar on stage.
The kids in the band in the show have to sort of gain in proficiency as the show goes on, right?
Right. That's true. They start out as, I think, classical musicians, so to speak, and then turn into rock and rollers. You know, it's a huge acting job on top of the music. They need to sell that they're adults and the emotional parts that go with it and the parents and, you know, they're they're learning and really doing it. It's turning into a really good show.
Deborah Blachowiak is the secretary-treasurer of the Hawaii Children's Theater on Kauai and the producer of Andrew Lloyd Webber's School of Rock, the musical youth production, which runs weekends until November 27th at the Kauai War Memorial Convention Center. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Baby, we was making straight A's, but we were stuck in a dumb days. Don't take much to memorize your lies. I feel like I've been hypnotized. And then the magic man come to town. Who he done spun my head around. He said recess is incension, 2 and 2 make 5. And now, baby, now I'm alive.
Glad we had a little bit of lightness in today's show, too.
I know. We're going to be looking for all the lightness we can find in the weeks and months and years to come, I suspect.
Well, and the fact is that, you know, life has a complement of both serious and more lighthearted elements to it, and not to make light of anything that happened last week in the election, how people are feeling about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't go wallowing in that for all of your time, otherwise you begin to lose yourself too.
Well, you know, we're seeing a wave of protests across the country in ways that no other presidential election, at least in this century, has brought about. And I do find myself wondering what the effect of those will be. You know, the message is getting sent, fine, but what happens as a result of that message being sent?
Yeah, that's the then what question.
Yeah.
And what happens as we move into the inauguration and then in years past, as we talked about that a little earlier with Liz Reese from World Can't Wait. She's saying, you know, this is what we're going to be looking at for the next, you know, 3-4 years going through the presidency. And some would wonder, is this taking us back to what people felt in the Vietnam era, where there were so many ongoing protests and nothing really was quelled?
Well, it took a very long time for those to have an effect, so we'll just have to see.
We will. And we're going to be back with you tomorrow. We're going to have a look at what Neil Conan sees from the farm. Also, we'll be speaking with Josh Benton from Neiman Labs about their article on the effect of online journalism on the last election.
And we'll have some shamelessly sentimental French songs performed live in our studio.
Meanwhile, we like to hear from you, shameless or not, on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show or want a past one, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.